Would you turn your Bibles, please, to the book of Romans and the first chapter? We'll be looking in verses 14 through 16 in just a moment, in which the Apostle Paul makes three I am statements. Now, when you think of I am statements in the Scriptures, probably you think first of the great I am statements made by Jesus the Lord, particularly recorded in the Gospel of John. There are some seven statements of that Jesus makes regarding Himself. I am the door. I am the way. I am the good shepherd. I am the light, and so forth. But the Apostle Paul makes three great I am statements that are quite instructive to us. For in the things that he says that he was, we can be, and we ought to strive to be. So I ask you, if you would, to look in this text in Romans chapter 1, and we'll begin looking at verse 14, where he says, I am under obligation both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. So, for my part, I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God to salvation, to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. I am under obligation, I am eager, and I am not ashamed. Three things. Can we say the same of ourselves? Look with me, if you would, at the things that Paul says here. The first is that I am under obligation, there in verse 14. What Paul was declaring in this simple statement was, very simply, that he was faithful to the obligations of the gospel. He was recognizing that he had individually, specifically, some duties, some obligations that related to the Lord's gospel. He saw himself as being indebted to Jesus in certain regards. He wrote, for instance, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 19 and 20. To the Corinthian Christians, that you are not your own, you were bought with a price. Paul actually made a number of statements in his writings along that same line of how we as Christians are the possession of the Lord's. We are not our own. We have been bought. We have been purchased at a price, at the price of Jesus' own life. I suspect that there are many people today in our independent, individualistic culture that would kind of recoil at the idea of belonging to someone. I don't belong to anyone. I'm my own man. But yet what the message of the gospel is that we do belong to someone. Someone who paid a terrible price in order to purchase us. We are not our own. We're bought with the price. Listen to what the Apostle Paul said on a couple of other occasions. In Titus chapter 2, for instance, he, in writing to the young preacher Titus and encouraging him and instructing him on how he was to carry out his work in the island of Crete, he says in chapter 2, in verse 14, regarding Jesus, who gave himself for us to redeem us from every lawless deed and to purify for himself a people for his own possession, zealous for good deeds. You get the idea there again? We are a possession. We belong to someone. We belong to the Lord who paid with his own life. You want to know if you really are a person who has this idea, this concept about yourself, that you belong to the Lord, that you are His possession? Did you notice what he says at the end of verse 14 of a manifestation of what these people are like? He says that they are people who are zealous for good deeds. They are zealous. They are fervent. They are committed to the performing of the good deeds that the Lord has identified as that which He wants His people to do. Now, if you want to know whether or not you indeed are one who looks upon yourself as being the possession of the Lord, here's a way to judge it. Are you zealous for the good deeds of the Lord, to the performing of those good deeds? 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and in verse 15, we find where Paul writes again along these same lines. He says that He died, Jesus again, He died for all, so that they who live might no longer live for themselves, but for Him who died and rose again on their behalf. You want to know? Am I a person who really views himself as one who belongs to the Lord? Here's another way of judging it. He says that Jesus died for all so that they who live might no longer live for themselves. Are you living for yourself? Benjamin Franklin once said about a man all wrapped up in himself makes a mighty small package. And that's true. People who are wrapped up in themselves, who are living for themselves, are people who cannot possibly be the possession of Jesus Christ. Why? Because they're not living for Him. They're living for themselves. So the first thing that we need to acknowledge that the apostle says to us in this great passage in Romans chapter 1 is that we're a people who have obligations to the gospel. And that, like Paul, we should be a people who can say, I am under obligation. I have a duty that is owed to the one who bought me, who paid the price for me. Do you see yourself as indebted to Jesus? We sing a song a lot of times. We would do well to ask ourselves if it's true, if we really mean it, and if it's an accurate statement of our lives. Jesus paid it all. All to Him I owe. Sin had left a crimson stain. He washed it white as snow. And people who are truly convinced of that and committed to that are people who look upon themselves truly as being possessed and being the possession of the Lord. But Paul says something else in this verse about what he owes, about his indebtedness. He says at the end of verse 14, he says, I'm under obligation to Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. He says, there's a sense in which I owe everybody. Now, I don't know about your finances. I know sometimes it feels like I owe everybody. But there is a real sense in which that's exactly what Paul was saying about his obligations. I owe everybody. There is a sense of indebtedness that I have to all, to Greeks and barbarians. Paul is saying he owes a debt to everyone to share the gospel with them, to anyone that he has the opportunity to anybody who would listen, to anybody who would give him the occasion. He owed them this. Let me ask you to imagine something for a moment. Imagine you were contacted by the governor of the state and you were given a pardon that you were to take to a prison somewhere in this state and deliver that would pardon a person who had been found guilty of a crime for which they were soon to be executed. And so you took this pardon that was written out by the governor and you stuck it in your pocket. And you went to work and you got busy with the projects at work. And a few days go by and you discover in your pocket that pardon. And you say, oh boy, I really need to get that up there to the prison. But, you know, you had a vacation planned with the family that has come along now, and so it's off for the vacation. You go. And then when you get back from the vacation, you know, there's so many things now that you've fallen behind on at work, and the kids have got to catch up with things in their schedule, and you're here and you're there and you're busy, and you come across that pardon that you've put aside somewhere, and you say, I really need to get to that. I mean, that's important, and I need to take care of that. And so finally, you pick up the paper one morning as you're ready to go to off to work, and there on the front page is the account of the execution that has taken place at the state prison. And the person whose pardon you held in your hands has now been put to death. How would you feel? And you say, well, David, that's kind of a silly story. And I admit that. But it makes a point, I hope. How should we feel when our neighbors, our friends, our co-workers, our family members, the people who are in that circle of associates that every one of us has, how will you feel when that person's laid into their tomb and the clods of dirt are thrown down on their casket? And they're gone from this life. And that pardon that you and I have, that so many times we tuck away in the inside coat pocket, or we put it on a shelf somewhere, and that which is the pardon to men and women that will deliver their souls for an eternity lies off to the side somewhere while we conduct the busy and important aspects of our life. I want to tell you who can do something like that. It's people who don't have a sense of an obligation, the sense of an indebtedness to those that we might be able to save with the gospel of Christ. And we need to think long and hard about whether or not we are people who have a real sense of the fact that I owe people this truth that has saved me. But now Paul makes another statement, as we've seen. He says, not only am I under obligation, but he also says, I am eager. And just as he had been faithful to the obligations of the gospel, in this verse 15, we see that he is flexible to the opportunities of the gospel. I'm eager. What is that picture? What does that conjure up in your minds? To me, it conjures up the idea of a guy who says, hey folks, I'm ready to go. I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. And I'm ready to preach the gospel to you also. You know what he's saying there is, folks, I've been busy doing this all over. I've been doing this for a lot of folks. But I'm eager to do it for you too. I'm eager to come to you in Rome and there to teach the gospel, because I have an opportunity to do it. If you know the life of the Apostle Paul, you know how that opportunity came to him. How he had been arrested by the Jews in Jerusalem to be put on trial. The Romans intervened in that and kept the Jewish leaders from putting Paul to death. He became their prisoner. And eventually, as the Lord revealed to him, he had to make an appeal to Caesar to decide his case. And just as the Lord had said to him, you will go to Rome and you will bear witness of my name in Rome, just exactly as the Lord had said, it worked out for the Apostle Paul. And so here we see him as he writes to these brethren, and he writes about the fact that I'm eager to come. Whatever occasions, whatever the circumstances might be that would eventually bring him there, I'm eager. I'm eager to come. He remained ready to teach people. Always ready. Are you ready? Are you ready to live for Jesus? Are you ready to teach Jesus to others? Oh, don't you remember that great account in Acts, the 8th chapter, when Philip went along that desert road and encountered that Ethiopian eunuch and who was reading from Scripture? And Philip asked him that wonderful introductory question, "Do you understand what you're reading?" He says, "Well, how can I? Except someone to help me." And he took that passage that he was reading from in Isaiah chapter 53, and Luke writes in Acts that from that passage he began to preach to him Jesus. You know why Philip did that? He did it because he was ready to do it. He was ready to go. I'm always amazed at that story in Acts, the 8th chapter, because before Philip went to the Ethiopian eunuch in that desert road to teach to that one single man, he had been in Samaria. He had been preaching to a city full of people. He had been widely acclaimed and received. I mean, he had a gospel meeting going like no gospel meeting I've ever seen, I suspect. And what's always kind of intrigued me is I'm afraid that some of my preaching brethren, including this preacher, might say, "Well, I can't go and speak to that one guy. I've got something big going here. I'm doing something important." Well, Philip could go, and Philip did go, because Philip was ready to go anywhere. He's like Paul. "I'm eager to go." Are you? May I say this to you? That it may very well be that one reason we don't have the kinds of opportunities and the numbers of opportunities that we would like to have that move us sometimes to say, "Oh, woe is me. The people just won't listen like they used to." It may very well be because we are not eager to go. We are not looking, anxious for, eager for those opportunities, whether it be to a great number of people or whether it be just to one single friend, neighbor, loved one, or stranger. Are you eager to go? Came across this story, I think illustrates an aspect of the tragedy of not being eager to do what we're trained to do and what we're called upon to do. The story is a true story. I think it comes from about 1985 in the city of New Orleans. It happened in that year that in all of the municipal city pools, not one single person drowned. And so, as a recognition of that, in order to celebrate, all of the lifeguards gathered on one day at one of the pools in order to celebrate. There were 100 lifeguards there, some 200 people all together with their guests and family members and so forth. And the party went on as a great time. Everybody had so much fun. But it began to break up, and as people began to leave and the crowd began to thin out, the tragic discovery was made of a body in the bottom of the deep end of the pool. And the lifeguards jumped in and pulled the body out and tried to revive the person, but could not. That man had drowned in the presence of 100 lifeguards while they were busy celebrating their successes. Now, my point to you is this. It's good, it's right that we celebrate the successes of teaching people the truth and seeing them obey the truth But we need to be careful that we don't become so consumed in our celebrations of our past successes that we fail in the present to do what we can and what we should do, what we're capable of doing, what we're trained to do. Paul wouldn't let that happen because he was eager. He had a sense of an obligation. He had a sense of eagerness to perform his obligation. And he said, finally, I'm not ashamed. He said in this statement in verse 16 that we're so many familiar with, that he was fearless in the face of the opposition to the gospel. He took to Rome a message about a Jewish carpenter, a message about a character that would impress no one in Rome. Not any of the high-powered, influential persons who lived there. He was speaking about the calling of this Jewish carpenter that elicited responses, he describes in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, from not many who are noble, not many who are wise, not many who are mighty. But yet, how many times did Paul write about his love for these kinds of people? These who would respond to that gospel. They're a worthy bunch of people. They are today. One of my favorite passages, I know I've cited it many, many times to you, it's found in Hebrews chapter 11, where the writer speaks about people of faith and he describes them as those of whom the world was not worthy. Same kind of people today who have responded to that gospel call. People that we ought to be grateful for. People that we ought to be impressed by, our fellow brothers and sisters. Not because of what they have done per se, not because of necessarily who they are, other than the fact that they are the people who responded to the call of Christ. But now let me ask you this. Are you ashamed of that people? Are you ashamed of those kinds of people? It's easy to become so in a world, much like the New Testament world, where worldly wisdom, worldly power, worldly might, worldly possessions, where all of those kinds of things are esteemed and considered to be the measures of success. When you start talking about people who don't have a lot of those things, those who are not noble, those who are not wise, those who are not powerful, when you start talking about those kinds of people, it can very well become so that we are ashamed. It can very well happen that we can become ashamed even of that gospel message that calls us. Are you ashamed of that message? Are you ashamed to let your friends at school, your friends at work, know of your belief in the Bible? Of your commitment to following it, obeying it? Of your determination to, or at least your obligation, if not determination, to share that message with other people? Are these things that bring embarrassment to you? Well, what we're seeing in the Apostle Paul is the example of one who says, no, I'm not ashamed of that message. I'm not ashamed of that gospel. And though in the halls of the emperor, in the palaces of the powerful people, among Jewish leaders, anywhere, even though these people and this message might be looked down upon as being unimportant or unacceptable. I'm still not ashamed of it. And Paul, with his lack of shame in the gospel, was still eager to preach it, still eager to meet his obligations to that gospel. I want to give you just one other statement found in another letter by Paul in 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter, where he says in verse 10, "But by the grace of God, I am." It's another I am statement. "By the grace of God, I am what I am." You thought Popeye said that, didn't you? No, it was Paul. "I am what I am." What was he? "I'm a man who is under obligations, and I'm glad to be there. I'm a man who is eager to teach and to tell other people about the message of Christ. I'm a man who is not ashamed of the gospel of Christ." That's the kind of man I am. I am what I am because of the grace of God. The grace that He showed toward me that did not prove vain. I labored even more than all of them. Yet not I, but the grace of God with me. God help us to labor with all that we're able to be a people who recognize we're in debt. We've got bills to pay. And we're eager to do it. And we're unashamed of the God who has made us what we are. I am what I am, and you are what you are because of that grace of God. What Paul was, all that he ever claimed to be, all that we claim to be here, just Christians, people forgiven, people made right in God's eyes, not by our virtue, not by our power or our performance, but by God, by the grace of God. And you can be that too. And you can leave this place saying, "I am tonight what I am by the grace of God." If you would give your obedience to the same gospel that made Paul what he was. The gospel he learned from Ananias in Damascus. The gospel that brought him to the point where he was urged to delay no longer, but to arise and be baptized and wash away his sins. Don't you delay any longer. Become what you ought to be. If you believe Jesus is God's Son, turn from your sins tonight, confessing Him to be Lord, be baptized, wash the guilt of sins away, and then leave here with the obligations and the eagerness and the unashamedness that every Christian ought to have. Won't you come to Him while we stand and sing?